everyone, and welcome back to another episode on the BTS podcast. I'm your host, Ciara Minova, and in today's episode, we are discussing effects of antidepressants. Our guest speaker today, who I am delighted to speak with, is Dr. Mark Horowitz. Dr. Horowitz is a trained psychiatrist, having done part of his training in Australia, and is now working in London as a clinical research fellow in the NHS and an honorary clinic research fellow at UCL, University College London. He has completed his PhD in the neurobiology of depression and the pharmacology of antidepressants at the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology, and Neuroscience at King's College London. During his PhD, he received two prizes for the British Association of Psychopharmacology, one for his PhD work and one for public communication. I am delighted to speak with him today. Dr. Horowitz, welcome. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for inviting me on, Ciara. Very nice to be here.
Thank you. I've been wanting to deep dive into this narrative for a very long time. Today's discussion, I think, is very timely and one where, unfortunately, I've always treaded a little carefully, but one which I think is extremely important to bring to light. And some of the things that I would like to talk about with you today is, of course, the pharmacology, the way that they work, what they alter in the brain, and what effects they have on our psychological well-being, but also on our physical body. But to be able to get into that, we first need to understand what we currently know about depression. Most people know what depression is. A lot of people have felt depressed too. When we have an immense feeling of sadness that impacts our everyday functioning and lives. But depression has certain characteristics according to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or I would even say certain criteria that need to be met. Can we talk about what those criteria are according to the DSM and what is defined as depression?
So I think it's probably more interesting to take a step back and understand what depression is and how it's come to be defined. So anyone can look up the 9 criteria for depression in the DSM manual: feeling low, feeling hopeless, changes to appetite, changes to sleep, need 5 out of 9 that last for 2 weeks and that impair your life to be diagnosed with depression. But that's not what depression is. That's what an organization in America has defined depression as. You know, I think we should step back and understand that depression is very common and definitions of it have changed over time. And I think the most important change over time is that depression in the earlier DSM, so I've just given you a rundown of some of the symptoms in the DSM-5, but earlier versions of the DSM talked about depressive reactions. In fact, everything in the DSM, DSM-1 and DSM-2 were reactions, anxious reaction, depressive reaction, psychotic reaction, and the reaction was to life circumstances. It was understood that people responded with sadness and hopelessness and despair when they lost things, when they were grieving, when life was difficult, maybe especially during childhood. In 1980, the DSM-3 committee, psychiatry as a profession was very much under attack by psychologists and therapy organizations with the premise, you guys aren't very good at therapy, but you're much more expensive than we are. Why? What is your point? And the response was, we're doctors and we're treating illnesses like other doctors. And consistent with that, they changed the DSM-3 away from being reactions to life to being medical disorders with capital letters. So depressive reaction became major depressive disorder, which is what you're talking about when you ask me what the criteria are. But that was a construction by the committee led by Robert Spitzer at the time, and it was designed to give medical legitimacy to the conditions that psychiatry was treating. And so the causes of depression went out the window. It wasn't you were depressed because of, it was you depressed if you had the following. For a long time after that, they had a grief exclusion. So if you had lost a loved one, someone close to you, within 6 months, then that was the exclusion for grief. It was explained by grief, and it wasn't depression. Over time, that exclusion was whittled down to now it's been removed from the latest DSM. And so if your mother has died or your partner has died and you're still having these symptoms for 2 weeks, you can be diagnosed with major depressive disorder. And so in doing so, they have removed the context from symptoms and made it sound that major depressive disorder is as real as a myocardial infarction or a heart attack. There are reasons why that has caused a lot of harm to people. If you look at people from the age up until the age of 45, as some researchers have, by the age of 45, 70% of people will meet a diagnosis of major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder. In other words, it's incredibly common to go through a period of feeling low and hopeless. We know that studies show very clearly that depression is related to the number of stressful life events you experience in any given period of time. So stressful life events are things like loss of a partner, being diagnosed with a physical illness, being laid off from work, and the relationship between the number of stressful life events in your life and your risk of being depressed are the steepest relationships I've ever seen in psychiatry. You know, if you have none of those events in your life, you have a very small chance of being depressed. If you have lots of them, you have a very high chance of being depressed. And that really harks back to the earlier DSM interpretations that depressive reactions are in response to what's happening in life. So I think that talking about them as a medical illness using DSM diagnoses, I think, is very misleading to people because it divorces people's emotions from the context in their lives. And I think it has all sorts of unforeseen consequences we might talk about more in this interview.
Wow, yeah. It's interesting because one of my following questions would be the causes of depression. And you were saying that we almost went from you are depressed because of a extremely debilitating life experience to you are depressed because of mechanisms or being imbalanced in your brain. So essentially, when I wanted to ask you the question, what causes depression? From what I'm understanding is that what you're almost saying is that, well, those theories, we cannot confirm them to be true. And instead, we know that at some point in everyone's life, someone is going to tend to be depressed. And that's almost a normal reaction to living because life is very difficult and we are all bound to face challenges and heartbreak in our lives. Am I understanding that correctly?
Perfectly. So exactly. You know, I sort of sometimes find it a bit almost humorous when people ask, what are the causes of depression? Because I feel like my grandma would get full marks on the test, and so would your grandma probably, because people have known what causes depression for all of history. When bad things happen, you feel depressed and demoralized, and sometimes it's bad enough you feel suicidal. But exactly as you've said, with the transformation of what I would describe as normal but very unpleasant reactions to life. You know, I think that's something that people are missing, that feeling despairing, feeling suicidal, feeling awful, you know, are fairly common. You know, every second day a celebrity comes out and says they've been through depression, you know, and everyone is very impressed because they're fighting stigma and it's a good thing. But, you know, the reason why so many celebrities are depressed is because so many different people go through periods of depression. It would be a pretty remarkable life to go through without having something, you know, a bit of rain fall down on your life to cause you to be down. And the studies back that up. By the age of 45, 7 out of 10 people are in that category. So when you start to say, what is the chemical cause of depression, which is what everyone is interested in, that's what I spent 5 years of my PhD trying to answer at the Institute of Psychiatry, I often think people are making a category error in that. So I think it's something like, you know, to make it slightly as sort of reductio ad absurdum, if a friend of yours said they were feeling very depressed and very grief-stricken because their mother had just died, and you said, look, I don't want to deal with the superficialities of this. I want to get into the core of it. I want to get you in a scanner and work out, is your amygdala firing too much or is your serotonin down low? You know, I don't want to talk about it. That's not really getting to the heart of things. You'd think that that was completely callous and absurd as a response, because of course the right response is, tell me about your mother. Let's you know, work through your grief, and you know, time will heal things. But I think that that category error is what animates the modern neuroscientific exploration of depression. So, you know, there are all sorts of theories about what caused depression. Is it increased inflammation? Is it low serotonin? Is it overactivity of the amygdala or underactivity of the left hippocampus? To some degree, I think all of these things are asking the wrong question. To use another slightly crude analogy, you know, when Microsoft Word on your computer stops working, when you have a bug, it is true to say that problem is happening in the circuits of the computer. But if you called up a software engineer and they started opening up the back of your computer and started soldering the circuits to fix the problem with Microsoft Word, you'd think that they'd missed the point, because the issue is in the software, not in the hardware. And I think all the science, as well as my grandmother's wisdom, is telling us the issue is in people's lives and in their minds, not in their brain. Now, I'm not a dualist or a supernaturalist. I think the mind is what the brain does. But I don't think it's the right level at which to understand what is going on. In the same way that understanding your friend's grief is about talking to them about their memories and their thoughts, not about opening up their brains and soldering something that's wrong with it. I think the same is true for depression. I think the questions to ask are, you know, about poverty, about insecure jobs, about relationship difficulties, not about chemical findings in the brain. And I think that is why, to summarize the field of neuroscience and depression, which I was a part of for several years, the findings are essentially nil. There's been 60 years of research. There's a neuroimaging study that put together all the findings, all the ways of looking at a brain, and they couldn't distinguish between a normal brain and a depressed brain. We did a review on serotonin levels in depressed people and healthy volunteers. There's been 60 years of research. There's no difference between people with depression and people that are healthy volunteers. The reason why there's no blood tests or scans when you turn up to a hospital and say you're depressed is because there are no robust findings in the field.
If we measure serotonin or other neurotransmitters, it's through the bloodstream, right? Which actually doesn't give us an accurate representation of what is going on in the brain.
They measure serotonin and its metabolites in the cerebral spinal fluid, the fluid around the brain. Mm-hmm. When people die, they cut up their brains and they measure amounts of serotonin in their brain. And they have started to look at nuclear imaging of serotonin receptors in live brains. So they look more closely than just the peripheral blood. But maybe you're heading towards one sort of mildly absurd part of the field, which is what is a normal level of serotonin? You know, there really isn't, you know, what would be about a chemical imbalance? What is a chemical balance? You know, and it's the brain is constantly changing. There's ups and downs. So it's not really clear that you could find such a thing as a chemical imbalance. So neuroscientists in this area or research psychiatrists would say the reason why we haven't found any changes on neuroimaging or in chemistry or in neurotransmitters is because we haven't looked hard enough and we need more precise or better equipment. It's very hard to say to prove that's not true. But another possibility would be we're looking in the wrong place and that, you know, I talked about incredibly strong findings in number of stressful life events versus depression. Compare that to changes in the brain with chemistry and there's almost no difference. So I think the research is telling us something about where to look.
Very interesting. But what about people who they know, they're aware that the drugs are not a long-term fix, but they're a quick fix? In those scenarios or situations, I'm just trying to understand your thought process. Would you say then if it's their own informed choice, then it's their choice? I wanted to know where you stand on that.
So if someone wants to take an antidepressant, where do I stand on that?
A
consenting adult can do whatever they like. I mean, right. They can take whatever chemical they like. They can have any procedure that they want. I think the important bit there is informed consent, what that means. And also, you said they are a quick fix. I would query that because the data on how effective antidepressants are is not very convincing. So I'm not sure that they are a quick fix. But if someone, after hearing information about their effectiveness, their adverse effects, the difficulty they could have in stopping them and how they properly work, decided to choose an antidepressant, that would be a completely legitimate choice for an adult to make.
Yeah. Depression, if we look at it and how it's looked at in terms of prevalence, it's classified as one of the most prevalent mental disorders, especially after COVID. I was recently reading a statistics from Champion Health, which is a website in the UK that collects data on employee well-being. And the statistics showed almost that around 17% of adults in the UK experienced it in 2021 compared to just, I think it was about 10% before the pandemic. And why this is important, at least to me, is because one of the frontline treatments, if I'm not mistaken, for depression is antidepressants. And since their discovery in the 50s, we've had a number of classes of antidepressants, now most commonly used as obviously SSRIs. So I'd love to understand, and for our listeners to understand, what exactly do antidepressants do? Or what do we know, at least, on how they work in the brain? Because, of course, we don't know all the mechanisms. And for the interest of time, perhaps we can focus more on SSRIs.
Sure. So I'll just say one point about the pandemic and the increase in depression. You know, mm-hmm. pandemic makes people feel lonely, makes their jobs insecure. There's all sorts of reasons why people might feel more demoralized and afraid and anxious. It would be peculiar if at the same time there was also an outbreak of a brain condition called major depressive disorder, you know, that coincidentally happened. So I think, you know, the language has become so embedded in our discourse, you know, that there's been an outbreak of a medical condition, you know, called depression. But I think if you think about things as responses to environments, it makes more sense. But anyway, I'll talk about antidepressants.
It's a natural response.
Yeah, I think so. Exactly. So how do antidepressants work? I think the short answer, the simplest answer, is we don't have any idea really what they do to the brain. There are lots of theories about, and there are really two broad types of theories. One theory says antidepressants are changing something in the brain that causes depression. They're reversing that underlying issue in the same way that, say, antibiotics kill bacteria in a lung infection. And people have, Joanna Moncrief, a professor of psychiatry, has called that the disease-centered model. And for a long time, people have focused on, do antidepressants work because they increase serotonin and depression is caused by low serotonin? That was the story put out by the manufacturers of the drugs for many years, that these drugs reverse an underlying chemical imbalance, namely low serotonin. It looks now, after 60 years of research, that there is no real evidence of there being low serotonin in depressed people. That's not just me saying that. Most prominent psychiatrists would say depression is not caused by low serotonin. The Royal College of Psychiatry in the UK took that off their website and it said that was a simplistic earlier description. Even in the American Psychiatric Association, which is generally a little bit slower to move on such things, it doesn't include that on their website anymore, and it's been taken out of most textbooks now. I think there's been a lag in the public's understanding of that. They still very much believe that depression has been shown to be caused by low serotonin. And I think GPs have been saying that to patients for many years. It's certainly been in the media. But there's general recognition now in medical circles that hypothesis hasn't borne out fruit. So antidepressants cannot be working by increasing serotonin and therefore fixing a chemical imbalance. There are other theories about that they may reduce inflammation. They may cause the growth of new neurons through a process called neurogenesis. There are issues with all of those theories. Number one, most of them come from animal studies. Very rarely are they done in humans. And number two, and just to focus on the neurogenesis or the growth of new neurons theory, which was something I spent years looking at in the lab when I did my PhD, there was an idea that hadn't been brought to my attention during my PhD, would have caused me quite some alarm during it, which is one of the things that causes the growth of new neurons is damage to the brain. So strokes cause the growth of new neurons, chemical damage to the brain, or trauma, in the same way as if you cut your skin, skin cells will grow back as a repair mechanism. So it's not clear to me that the growth of new neurons in the brain in animals given antidepressants is a good thing. It may be a sign of damage to the brain caused by abnormal levels of serotonin, because that's the other thing to think about. Antidepressants do increase serotonin in the short term in the brain. That's certainly been shown. If in depressed people's brains there is no abnormal chemistry, then increasing serotonin is creating an abnormal chemistry in the brain, and it's possible that that may be damaging. We know in animals given MDMA or ecstasy, which increases serotonin, that you get the death of neurons at higher doses. Antidepressants act in a broadly similar way to ecstasy or MDMA, abnormally increase serotonin. So it is possible that they are causing harm to the brain, and the growth of new neurons is a response to that. So in general, I would say all those biological theories as to how antidepressants work, one, none of them have been shown in humans. There are essentially hypotheses with different bits of work going on about them. So then there's a second way of understanding how antidepressants work, and that is what Professor Moncrief calls the drug-centered model. And that is more like this, and it's true actually of psychiatric drugs in general. Rather than fixing an underlying issue like antibiotics do with bacteria, psychiatric drugs have psychoactive effects. They change the way you think and feel. Whether you have a mental health condition or not. In the same way as, for example, drinking alcohol makes everybody feel more calm and relaxed. And if you had a social anxiety disorder and you drank alcohol, you would suddenly have less anxiety in social circumstances.
Yeah.
No one thinks that alcohol has changed the underlying cause of social anxiety. Everyone understands you've superimposed
right.
a feeling of relaxation that will wear off when the drug wears off. And if you think about antidepressants in that way, then you could ask, what do they actually do to people? What are the psychoactive effects?
Mm-hmm.
And the strongest effect that comes out of surveys of people on antidepressants is that they cause emotional numbing. They cause a diminishment of the range of emotions, both positive and negative. And you can see how somebody who was having great anxiety or terrible depression might quite like having their emotions turned down from a 10 to a 3. You could also see how in the long term that might cause them issues because it may affect their quality of life, it may affect their relationship. The emotional numbing is reported by at least half of patients in surveys, sometimes three quarters. It's been linked to the genital numbing that people report on antidepressants. And I also found out when writing about how to come off antidepressants that if you crush up an antidepressant and swish it around your mouth, it'll actually cause numbing of your mouth. There is, you know, a little bit of evidence that it does act as a mild anesthetic agent to emotions and to genital tissue and maybe even to into other sensory organs. And
that's
so
crazy.
I think overall, given the lack of evidence for the biological mechanisms of antidepressants that people are looking at, it seems to me the most obvious explanation is that they probably numb people's emotions. And that may be useful for some people in the short term, but it may also have unforeseen consequences in the long term.
Wow. Dr. Horwitz, you're a psychiatrist, and so obviously your work consists of prescribing medication to your patients. So I'd actually really like to understand how it works in actual medical practice in the UK, because I know you're based in the UK. So the actual process of prescription, meeting your patients, how is that all done? And when does it happen that it's the GP that prescribes it? And when does it happen that the psychiatrist does?
Sure. So I'll talk about the UK. At least 85% of antidepressants are prescribed by GPs, not by psychiatrists. Vast majority is by GPs. What is the process of prescribing? Probably I'll talk about GPs. Not exactly sure what it would look like, but people, I think one in three consultations by a GP involve a mental health condition. GPs have a variety of options to either prescribe antidepressants or you may be aware that NICE puts guidelines out for treatment of different conditions in England. It guides what doctors do. For less severe and more severe depression, there are 21 options for doctors to dispense. And out of those 21 options, three of them involve medication and 18 involve other treatments. Other treatments include various forms of therapy, from cognitive behavioral therapy to brief psychodynamic therapy or interpersonal therapy, group exercise. I think mindfulness is one of those treatments.
Yes.
For severe depression, actually in the analysis done by NICE, the treatment that was the most cost-effective, because of course everyone's very concerned about saving costs in the NHS, the most cost-effective treatment was problem-solving therapy, which I think is very eloquent in that it's people's problems that get them into trouble, and so it makes sense that problem-solving therapy is what might help them get out. In the comment by the committee members who were on that, they decided to knock problem-solving therapy down. And the reasoning was because doctors are more accustomed to prescribing medication or recommending CBT than they are to dispensing things like problem-solving therapy. And so I think there is a culture of where people are used to therapy and antidepressants. We know that many more people will get antidepressants than therapy. So in England, in a given year, 8 million people will get antidepressants and 1 million people will get therapy. Patients' preference for therapy and antidepressants is reversed. People would prefer therapy three times as much as people who would prefer antidepressants. Part of it comes down to availability, longer waiting list for therapy. I think it's several weeks or months in different parts of the country. Of course, antidepressants are very cheap and very easy to give. I think GPs, you know, have 10-minute consultations. There's a lot of pressure on them. They see, you know, dozens of patients a day. I think they want to do something to be helpful to people, and the easiest thing they can do is to prescribe an antidepressant. And I think that's what the pressures are that drive them to do that quite often.
So basically there's this inability to connect and understand the person because there's almost only enough time to understand the symptom.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunately true. I don't want to, you know, apportion blame to GPs. They're working in a very tough system. They have, you know, they're under a lot of pressure. The NHS is being squeezed of funding in this country. And so GPs, I think, are faced with a lot of the problems of society in England. You know, there's a cost of living crisis, there's poverty, there's job insecurity. And I think GPs are faced with the unbearable task of dealing with that. And they've got very limited instruments.
Yeah, this kind of goes back to a question I always ask myself, whose role is it? Why is it the role of the GPs to, you know, solve people's problems? Essentially, as you said, people experience anxiety, people experience depression because of a problem that is happening in their life. And why is it the role of the GPs to handle that? And
I think you're exactly right. And I think it is very difficult because this comes back to that. This all comes back to that choice that was made to see these things as illnesses.
Right.
Because if it's an illness, then that is in the domain of doctors. But I think it is very unfair for GPs to be put in the position of trying to solve, you know, life problems. It's not where their skills have generally been, but they've been put in that hot seat, and it makes life hard, I think, for everyone. There's been a move in England to move away from that to some degree. There's now social prescribers, and there's something called, I think, health and wellbeing workers that are trying to direct people away from medical solutions to life, to issues with pain and distress, which is growing in some areas of the country. I think it's a very good initiative.
Yeah, that's excellent. I'd love to talk a little bit about your background as well. While you were training to be a psychiatrist, I believe in parallel to that, you were also taking antidepressant drugs. Firstly, maybe very briefly, how did you get interested in psychiatry? And then what kind of happened during this period?
So they say that you specialize in your defects. So, of course, I was interested in psychiatry for the most cliched reason of wanting to solve my own problems, and those are my family. I come from a neurotic Jewish family. If you've ever seen any Woody Allen films, you would have seen my family on screen shouting and worrying and worrying about. I read Freud at high school. You know, I considered it all to be very interesting and deep, and I went into psychiatry to fix my family, fix myself. Along the way, I was prescribed antidepressants when I was 21. I was in third year medical school. I was a miserable young man, reading Kafka and Nietzsche, as the cliche goes. And I was upset about the, I wasn't sure it was medicine was the right choice. I had all sorts of conflicts. I went to see my GP. In a few minutes, they recommended an antidepressant, and I was quite happy. I was really keen actually to get that drug. I'd heard friends and family were on it. I had tried some self-directed CBT using a book, and I wanted something. And I remember thinking, you know, I either have to start my life all over again, change course, change who I am, you know, or there's something wrong with me and I need a medication. I decided to go with the second one. So I remember being very excited to start the drug, and like, you know, I guess like lots of people at that time, I was given an SSRI that was new on the market in Australia. That's where I was at that time. I took it. People always asked me, did it have any positive effects? I can't really remember. I had a lot of side effects. I remember feeling slightly odd. Things seemed a bit weird around me. I remember feeling a bit dizzy. I had a funny yawning sensation. I went back a few times to change my medication because I thought I'm not reacting very well to it. Eventually, I just settled on a drug because I thought, oh, they're all imperfect. I'll just stick to this one. And the drug I stayed on for now 20 years is called Lexapro, or escitalopram is the chemical name for it. And I took it for many years, a little bit ambivalent about what it was doing, but I thought everyone says it's good for you, so I should probably keep taking it.
You recently partook in a documentary by the BBC Panorama program called The Antidepressant Story. And basically, the main focus of this documentary was that people have not been properly warned about the very significant dangers of withdrawal problems. Before we go into kind of what that was all about, what are some of the main effects if briefly, you mentioned a few like emotional numbing, you said excessive yawning and all of that. But what are some of the most common effects that or side effects that people report during taking antidepressants?
Okay, so that's during taking rather than during withdrawal, because they're slightly different, of course.
Yeah, so I thought we could start with taking and then we can go into withdrawal. Yeah.
Okay, so during taking, some of the most common side effects are the emotional numbing that I mentioned. So more than half of people in survey say they have emotional numbing. There was some debate about, is that caused by the depression or the drugs? And earlier this year, there was an article reported in The Guardian that even in healthy volunteers given antidepressants, they also experience emotional numbing. More than half of people experience sexual dysfunction. That can range from less desire for sex to an inability to sustain an erection or trouble with orgasm in both sexes. Cognitive impairments, so trouble with memory, trouble with concentration, are very common. And on the side, manufacturers put that on their patient leaflets in a lot of the antidepressants that are commonly used. Weight gain is an issue. It was said for a while that SSRIs don't produce weight gain, but longer-term studies have found that they do. They produce several kilograms of weight gain on average in people who use them long-term. People can be nauseous on the drugs. People can have trouble with sleep. Daytime tiredness is a very common side effect of antidepressants. Then there are the physical health consequences of taking antidepressants in the long term. So there are no long-term studies of antidepressants versus placebo. The longest studies go for 12 weeks. So what they've done to look at long-term effects is large observational studies of people taking antidepressants versus those that are not. And in those studies, they find that people on antidepressants have a greatly increased risk of cardiovascular disease, strokes, falls, osteoporosis, cataracts, and an early death. There's a debate about whether that's because of their depression or because of the antidepressants. But for at least some of those conditions, it's hard to understand how depression might cause cataracts or osteoporosis. At least a degree of that increased risk is because of the antidepressants themselves. But we really don't know because it hasn't been studied. So those are probably the main issues with being on antidepressants.
You know, there was a talk recently about mental health that I attended, and one of the clinicians, she was just talking about, you know, different symptoms that women may have in different ages and stages in her life. And somehow the topic of depression came up. And one of the things that she mentioned, SSRIs are very, you know, helpful for depression. And then she goes on to say that in the past, you know, we've had different forms of antidepressants, which had immense side effects. But the current ones, the ones that we have today, they are, have absolutely no harm. They're perfectly safe to take. And I'm sure she genuinely believes that. I'm sure she wasn't trying to misinform. But I was sitting there and, of course, I didn't say anything. But in my head, I thought there's so much disconnect, or there's, I don't know how even clinicians are not informed of these side effects that are a huge possibility with taking these drugs.
And in one sense, she's right, but the bar she's using as what counts as not many side effects is a very low bar, because the older drugs, the tricyclics and the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, you know, are toxic, are deadly in overdose, whereas it is harder to overdose on SSRIs. That was how they were first marketed. And that's true. I think they are less toxic in overdose. So if you use the bar of they're not deadly, then yes, SSRIs are safer than the older drugs. If you use the bar of they have no negative effects on people's quality of life, then I think that's, as you say, very misleading. I suspect that your professor, you know, is swimming in the same soup as everybody else. And that is the messaging around these drugs, that they are benign, that they're as safe as paracetamol. That's what I was taught. Yes, there's a few niggling effects here and there, but basically there's no big deal. I think in part that comes out of the way studies are done. Studies are normally go for 8 weeks, very short-term sampling of people. I think in the long term, issues can accumulate. And I also think that doctors in general, I feel that was true of my education, are taught to downplay issues. Now, I know doctors that will say, look, don't read this patient information leaflet, because a lot of what I'm saying is it's not my idea. A lot of what I'm saying, you could buy a packet of antidepressants, open up the leaflet inside it, and it lists all the things that I'm saying. I'm not saying anything different to what the manufacturers of the drugs say. I think that some doctors will say, look, don't bother reading this, it'll just scare you. But it's written by the lawyers, don't worry about it. You know, the drug is you know, fairly safe. I now think the opposite. I think I used to say something like that. I now think the opposite. I say, look, this is written by the lawyers. Therefore, it's really important. They wouldn't put it in if it wasn't really important. You know, you should read all these things because these are all possibilities. And most people who read those things, it's a bit shocking how many common and very common side effects there are. And again, I think your professor probably has this mindset of, look, these drugs are generally good for people, right. So we shouldn't discourage them from taking it by talking about negative things. And I think there's a sort of paternalism behind that we know what's best for patients. I've learned the hard way that that's not always so clear. We don't always know. Long-term effects are different from short-term effects sometimes, and I think people should be informed about what the possibilities are on both sides, what the benefits are and the negatives. I think that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was definitely done in good faith. She was a clinician, actually. So going back to withdrawal, I would really love to talk a little bit about that. I mentioned the documentary, which I'd be happy to link to this episode description. But during, basically, there were reports of many sexual problems, which were arising even during, I think, the administration of the SSRIs, but basically that persisted after they discontinued the drugs. And please correct me, which is now what is called PSSD, post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, a consequence of the drug. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? And if it's not private of me to ask, is this something that you had encountered yourself or any other withdrawals after?
So I'm possibly not the expert on PSSD, but I'll tell you what I know. So I mean, I think it's one of many withdrawal symptoms. It's been branded separately. I think about it as part of the spectrum of issues that people have when coming off the drug. So withdrawal symptoms from antidepressants include a combination of psychological and physical symptoms. The psychological symptoms include low mood, anxiety, crying spells, panic, difficulty sleeping, a whole variety of different mental health symptoms. And it's those symptoms that provide people with the most confusion because they look a lot like a mental health condition. And so what happens often is people come off their drug, they report to their doctor, I feel terrible, I'm having panic attacks. And the doctor says, you know, I'll stop you there. Clearly what's happened is you've relapsed, you've had a return of your condition, you must need the drugs, you better go back to your antidepressant. You can see because there's very little awareness of withdrawal effects from antidepressants, but there's a lot of awareness of relapse, it's very easy to see why doctors would jump to the conclusion of this must be a relapse issue. It's very unfortunate because people are getting, therefore, the wrong diagnosis and the wrong treatment, because the right treatment for withdrawal would be, we've learned by the way you've come off, you need to come off more slowly, not that you need the drug. You know, in some ways, it's sort of like saying to somebody, if you quit smoking and you feel irritable and anxious, you must need to keep smoking to prevent anxiety and irritability.
Yeah,
what you've learned is you need to come off it more slowly. The other group of symptoms people get in withdrawal are the physical symptoms. And the reason why you get both is because serotonin and the other chemicals affected by antidepressants affect all the different organ systems in the body, you know, the brain, but also the gut and the hormonal system and the neurological system more widely. And so some of the symptoms people get in withdrawal are dizziness, headache. People can get a little electric zaps in their brain. People describe a little lightning bolt in their head or their brain being switched off for a second. They can get gut troubles. Some people can get a horrible movement disorder where they feel extremely restless and agitated, and they pace backwards and forwards because they feel so stirred up inside. And some of these people feel so tortured by this sort of condition that they end up taking their lives. So it can be a very extreme experience coming off antidepressants. You know, for a long time, it was said to be mild and brief, bit of a headache, a couple of days off work, no big deal. But actually what we understand now is it can last for months, sometimes years, and can be very debilitating. People find it surprising when you say it can take months and years because the drugs leave your system in just a few days, but it's the changes to the brain that can take months and years to go back to normal. That's why they can last for so long. Sexual issues occur while you're on the drug. As I mentioned before, at least half of people will report that on the drug. And it seems in some people that it persists for long periods afterwards. And there is some, I guess there's some debate in the field. Is it a persisting kind of effect on the brain or the peripheral nervous system? Or is it a withdrawal symptom? I think that I tend to be on the side of people who think it's a withdrawal symptom, like other withdrawal symptoms, because I've come across people that have had it, and over time it's gotten better. Sometimes it's taken months and years, like other symptoms. There's a very active group of people with PSSD who are trying to get further awareness for the topic, and I think it's a very important issue. Of course, if you were told that on starting a drug you may have years of trouble with sexual function, you might think twice about it. I think there's a study that says that 1 in 200 people may experience it, which, you know, given that a lot of the conditions people are treated with antidepressants for would probably resolve by themselves over time, you know, to risk long-term or possibly permanent, I'm not sure about that, effects from the drugs, I think should give people pause. But I'm not exactly sure what the mechanisms are underlying all these issues. There's a lot of talk about serotonin, which has a big effect on sexual function. I think more research is needed really into the whole area of what do antidepressants do to the brain and what are the effects that last after you stop them. I think it's a very important area that needs further research.
Absolutely. I think Dr. Moncrief, she looks into that or tries to at least tackle those questions as well. I recently had come across a lot of groups on Twitter on PSSD, and it's very, you know, it kind of breaks your heart to see for sure that this was not information that was given to patients before taking the drug. So it does make you think on how this should most definitely be communicated. I even remember you wrote a recent tweet that after the documentary, you'd received over, I think, 300 emails or so, people messaging you asking for help on how to come off, you know, antidepressants or how to deal with their withdrawal symptoms because, as you were saying, they were misdiagnosed as relapses by their doctors. And the most interesting aspect of it was that a lot of them were psychiatrists too, who wanted help off that. How did that make you feel? Because, you know, this is your field as well. This is your area.
I mean, I can't say a lot of them were. Some of them were psychiatrists. Some of them were GPs. I guess it just hammers home that the ignorance around these drugs. You know, I don't, some people get very, you know, paranoid that doctors are trying to do harm and they're trying to do, you know, I don't think that's generally true. A lot of my friends are psychiatrists, friends of mine are doctors. Everyone's trying to do the same thing. They're trying to help people. I think it's slightly different for some of the key opinion leaders. I think some of the people who are paid by drug companies have a much more conflicted interest in the area, and they're balancing a variety of different of motivations. But for most psychiatrists, you know, they're trying to help people, and like me, they think that what they're doing, the drugs they're giving, are helpful. You know, I took antidepressants because I thought they were useful. I'm you know, when I prescribed them to my patients, it wasn't because I thought that would be doing them harm. Of course, I thought I was trying to help them. And I think it just underscores how little understanding of these drugs most doctors have. My gag is that the first lecture I heard about how to stop psychiatric drugs was one that I gave. I had never had a lecture in medical school or my training on how to stop drugs, but I've been given hundreds of lectures on how to start the drugs. That reflects the studies that have been done. There are hundreds of studies on how to start antidepressants. There's a handful on how to stop them. You know, all of the lectures, all of the teachings about starting drugs and not stopping drugs. And so I think, you know, one of the most startling emails was a GP saying, I've just realized on seeing the documentary that actually all these mini breakdowns I thought I had when I stopped antidepressants over the years for himself was actually withdrawal, and I didn't realize it. So, of course, you know, that ignorance to his own condition will be played out to his patients. Mm. And so I think there's just a lack of knowledge about what's going on.
That must have been so eye-opening for so many people. Yeah. Absolutely. And I agree with you. One of the most dynamic and wonderful psychiatrists that I know, his name is Dr. Alex Kermy. He's the podcast host for Maudsley Learning Podcast, and he's also a psychiatrist at the Maudsley Hospital. And he's extremely, you know, dynamic. He takes so many things into consideration, as in he has the patient's best interest in mind, you know, and I do know that sometimes there is a feeling from people who've been harmed that psychiatry wants to harm people. But I hope to believe otherwise, you know, that everyone has the same agenda in mind, which is to help and not to harm. You also published a paper in 2020 with some of your colleagues called The Patient Voice. Patients who experience antidepressant withdrawal symptoms are often dismissed, misdiagnosed with relapse, or a new medical condition, as we were just speaking about. I think these are very huge consequences, right? One is dismissal, one is misdiagnosis, and then the third one is a completely new diagnosis. How do you think we can bridge this gap? How would be the best way to, I don't know if I should say the word educate, but make clinicians aware of this?
It's a great question. It's the most important question in this field now. You know, you talked about a psychiatrist you know who you think is very thoughtful and well-meaning. You know, it is possible to be very thoughtful and well-meaning. I'm not saying about him in particular. I'm talking about
right.
In general, it is possible to be well-meaning and thoughtful and do harm. You know, doctors used bleeding people for years to treat conditions. They used lobotomies. They've used some coma therapy.
ECT.
ECT is still commonly practiced in England, treatment for various mental health conditions. There's a big debate about does it cause more harm than good, but currently it's in the NICE guidelines for various conditions. So, you know, it's very hard to have insight into all these things. I think an important starting point is to listen to patients. You know, I think there are a number of doctors that have opened their minds about this issue, and they're people who tend to listen to patients. It's a big dilemma, the education piece. You know, it's the solution to this issue. If doctors were to understand the harms of treatment, they would be much more cautious in prescribing drugs. They would probably use lower doses. They would use them for shorter periods of time. They would be thinking a lot more carefully about how to stop these drugs. They would provide adequate support. The government would also provide, you know, deprescribing clinics that help people stop. They would make all these other treatments, these different therapies and mindfulness and problem-solving therapy more widely available. There would be, you know, there'd have to be a reorganization of the way we manage mental health conditions. I think there are several barriers to that in doctors' minds. One is, you know, new information is hard to assimilate with old information. I think there's that you have to unlearn some things that you hold to be true. So taking the example of your professor who spoke in the UAE, you know, if you've been taught your entire career these drugs are safe, don't have many side effects, are highly effective, and someone comes out and says, I've been lying in bed for years, you know, I've got brain zaps, I can't think straight, I've lost my entire life because of these drugs. I think it's incredibly startling to doctors because it doesn't make any sense to them. I sort of think about myself.
Yeah.
If several years ago, before I'd gone, so I've, you know, I'd like to think that I've got to all these understandings by being very clever, but I haven't. I've got to them by being very stupid and going through it myself and had it, you know, chucked in my face. So if 10 years ago, before I'd gone through withdrawal from these drugs, if someone had said to me, you know, these drugs can be very dangerous and people can be, you know, debilitated and impaired by coming off them, I would have said, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
You know, these drugs, you know, they're not as safe as paracetamol, but they're not far off. You know, what you're saying people's genitals aren't working for years, you know, that doesn't make sense to me. It wouldn't have fitted my internal model.
Right.
And if one patient come out to me and said, look, I've having all these things, it would have been easier for me to think, look, this person must be nuts to say their penis isn't working, that they can't think straight. You know, the other thing is doctors like me, I'm a highly institutionalized person. I spent my entire life sitting in lecture theatres, listening to very clever people tell me things. You know, we all have a reverence for our professors and what we've been taught. So, you know, when one patient comes in and says, you know, everything you've been told is wrong, you know, on one side you've got dozens of people you respect for years, and then you've got a person, you know, who has a mental health condition, that's why they're seeing you. You know, they are a less reliable witness than all these professors you've seen. So I think there's an existing model in doctors' minds. It's very hard to displace. I find, like that GP that wrote to me about his own experience, the people that poke through the official story about these drugs are people that have either first-hand experience or close second-hand experience. Their sister, their mother, their wife has gone through it, and those doctors get a different perspective and realize that things are not quite right in the official story. That makes it very hard, really, to get the word out to everybody. Because I have, for example, doctors who come to shadow my clinic. I run a clinic where I take people off antidepressants. I run from London. And doctors who come to see it are often very skeptical about what they're seeing. They're seeing people complaining about horrible withdrawal symptoms. It sounds to them like mental health conditions. And I have to go through very carefully to say, no, look, this person got on the drug because they had anxiety about exams. In other words, a very normal, you know, very common condition. You know, now they're having light hurts their eyes, they're having headaches, they're very fatigued, they're having panic attacks, they're highly suicidal, they can't sleep at night. In other words, the symptoms they have now are well out of proportion to what they had when they went on the drug. This isn't a relapse. You know, these are completely new symptoms. And I think over time, the doctors who shadow my clinic do come round. They hear the same story again and again, you know, mild or moderate life problem to start with, get on the drugs, come off the drugs too quickly, terrible problems. You know, obviously it's a bit hard for me to go through every doctor in the country and take them to my and I think when you know, the paper that you mentioned, we talk about all these different cases of people that have trouble. I feel like a lot of doctors would read that and roll their eyes and think this can't be happening. Having said that, though, the NICE guidelines now actually outlines a lot of those symptoms as being part of withdrawal from antidepressants. It points out the condition can last for months. So I think there is some slow change.
That's promising.
Because authorities are talking about it. But it is a big shift. And I often use the hair test when thinking about doctors. People that have more hair than me, which is a lot of people, in other words, people that are younger than me, understand this because they're not displacing so much practice in the area. People with less hair than me, which unfortunately is a group getting smaller and smaller, don't generally push back and say, I've never seen this. You know, that's one of the things the doctors say. I've never seen this. And of course, when you read these papers and patient accounts, the reason they've never seen it is because when they have seen it, they've called it relapse. So it's very hard to see what you haven't been taught to see. So wow. I think there's an ignorance of the issue. Of course, doctors don't like the word being called ignorant. I wouldn't like it either. I don't like being told I'm wrong. You know, we all have our egos.
Right.
I think that's a very big part of things. But I hope doctors can be brought around, as they slowly are, to prevent a lot of the unnecessary suffering for patients.
Wow. Dr. Horst, that was very well said. That example that you gave, doctors having their internal models, and if something doesn't fit, it's almost that it's cognitive dissonance, right? If that doesn't fit it, it's very hard to change your thinking that you've adopted for so long. And especially, as you said, when it's people that you look up to, people's work that you admire, and you know what great work they do, it's very hard to shift that opinion. But you're right. We are becoming hopefully more open, being aware that we're not. I mean, that's at least what I hope, that the future is very promising.
You're young. You're still idealistic. Okay. It's nice. It's good.
No. But, you know, I think, if I'm being honest, I am very, very conflicted. I'm conflicted because, see, there's a lot of injustice in the practice and it makes me sad. But I'm also very hesitant to openly say this. Well, I am now. Great job. But because I don't want to upset those people who have taken it or want to take it and would feel otherwise and have had a very different experience. While we're highlighting extremely important things, there are people who it has helped, it has changed their life, and I also am hesitant to totally dismiss that. How can we balance this, I guess, paradox almost? How can we both safely, I guess, encourage and maybe not encourage at all?
It's a very good point. It's an important issue, and it's, you know, this is a very emotive topic. And I mean, the first thing to say is, you know, I'm not, people use phrases like pill shaming to, you know, I don't think that's, I think that's a, you know, a two-word slogan to shut down a discussion that we should be having, which is what is the balance of harms and benefits of different treatments. You know, I would say that's the core project of medicine and science, you know, medical science, is to understand what is the balance of harms and benefits. And as that changes, we should change our practice. So it can't be that we decide, you know, a drug is good and we don't question it ever again and we just go, that's not scientific, that's not what we do. As more facts come to light, we've got to change our minds appropriately. So I think the discussion is worth having. People do get very upset and I understand that. I've been in that position. So I'm not laughing at anybody. I'm not criticizing anybody. I'm trying to describe what's going on and give people information. So when I was doing my PhD in London, I saw a GP, this is now probably 10 years ago, and she said to me, I see you're on an antidepressant, been on it for many years, you seem to be doing quite well, you know, have you thought about stopping it? And I got very angry at her. I was outraged. I said, you don't understand what you're saying. If I am quite well, it's probably because of the antidepressant. You know, I'm a psychiatrist, I'm doing a big, important neuroscience PhD in these drugs. You don't know what you're talking about. Of course, I've been on the opposite side of that now. You know, I'm talking to people about stopping antidepressants or whether they should, you know, reconsider the balance of harms and benefits. And people have had that reaction to me and said, you know, right. you don't understand, these drugs are helping me, you know, you're maligning what I'm doing, you're criticizing my choices. So I've been on both sides of it, and I'm not, you know, I don't want to upset people, but I think people should be informed about what drugs are doing. And I think it's, you know, it's important to understand the benefits and the harms, the alternatives and the risks of stopping. So, you know, I guess when I talk, I'm talking from a position of, you know, I'm still on these drugs, I'm coming off them.
Right.
I've been on them for many years. I'm not criticizing people for choosing the drugs. I'm not saying they're weak. I'm not saying they made a bad choice. I'm seeking to inform. You talked about a group of people that say that medications have helped them, and I'm not taking anything away from them. I'm not saying they should stop. I'm not saying they should have the drugs taken away. But I think one thing is lots of people don't put together effects they're having from the drugs with the drugs. You know, when you take an antibiotic and you feel nauseous, you know, in the first couple of days, it's obvious it's the antibiotic. When you're on a drug for years or decades and it's having more subtle effects, emotional numbing, sexual effects, weight gain, it's not as easy to connect to the drug as it is taking a short-term drug. So I think a lot of people don't connect effects that they're having to the drugs. And I think some people are having lots of health problems, as I did, that were due to the drugs that they didn't put together. And I think that's important. You know, I had real troubles with tiredness, memory and concentration for many years that I was given various diagnoses for, and I didn't connect to the drug. And coming off the drug has made that a lot better. So it's been a very big improvement in my life. And I think that's true for lots of patients that I see. They have similar experiences.
So happy to hear.
Yeah, thank you. And so, you know, I think that's why I'm a little bit passionate about putting out this ideas, because lots of people have their lives improved by coming off the drugs because all these adverse effects go away. But I'm not trying to grab anything from anybody that they find helpful. You know, people can make their own decisions.
Very beautifully said. Thank you so much. My biggest issue is hearing things like, I got diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder, but I realized I was probably just stressed from med school. Or another one that I read was, as you mentioned earlier, my mom passed away a few months back, but I got diagnosed with major depressive disorder and put on very heavy pills. So it's things like that sometimes that we would need to just take a step back and think about what is happening to the person.
I'll just add to that. I think that diagnosis, you know, is a double-edged sword. I think it's very common that people find it a great relief to get a diagnosis. You know, I feel terrible, and now there's a name for it, and there's a doctor who knows about it, and it's a part of a group, and there's people know what to do. They're looking in a book. So I think there's great relief. I think in the long term, though, there can be an opposite effect where it becomes very self-limiting. People say, well, I've got to be careful because I've got generalized anxiety disorder. And if exactly as you've just said, if it's really just a response to something in life that will pass, as lots of things do, rather than a lifelong condition, people can be left with this residual message that there's something wrong with them or particularly fragile. And I think I've gone through that myself. Being diagnosed with depression gave me a sense of self that was tied up in fragility and, you know, being careful. And I think all these this very big shift in my ideas I've had over the last few years has taken that away. And I no longer feel like somebody with an inherently fragile mind, but somebody that had a tough period of time when I was younger. Yes, I'm a bit more neurotic than the average person probably, but I don't feel like I'm inherently broken, which is a very big deal, of course, in your self-image. So I think it is good, as you're saying, to problematize these diagnoses that seem so concrete and that people can carry with them inside for many years.
Absolutely. Earlier, you mentioned that one the most important aspect for you is informing, right? Giving people that information, just giving people the awareness of antidepressants. And I think a month back, well, it was in July, but once this episode will be released, it'll be a month back. So in July 2023, there was the Royal College of Psychiatrists International Congress, and they were tackling some of these issues. There were some great topics. I don't think the recordings are out yet, so I haven't watched them, so I can't really say how the topics went and didn't go. But I saw a lot on Twitter that there was kind of this, I don't know what the right terminology would be, but I would just say people were tweeting that how come the, I'm going to put in quotation marks, the other side, so the so-called critical psychiatrists, how come they were not invited to speak? So perhaps yourself or perhaps Dr. Moncrief or James Davies, et cetera. I don't even know if, you know, there's a certain criteria of people who can be invited to this Congress, I guess. But I think my question is more broader. Why are they not more open discussions? And maybe there are, but from what I'm seeing, it seems that there are so many great intellects that, you know, could come together and perhaps come to, I would say, not a conclusion, but at least work through these issues and these conversations. But it seems to be that there's almost a divide, and one group says, no, it's great. And, you know, these patients, it's one in 1,000, while the other side argues otherwise.
I'll choose my words carefully here to be,
yes,
be correct. I mean, I think it's sort of interesting what happened at that conference. You know, it's obviously, there was a lot of talks that were a reaction to our work about, you know, yes, they're not seeing low serotonin in depression, other criticisms of different medications and a focus on withdrawal symptoms. I guess it is because those ideas are threatening to psychiatry in lots of respects, because if the medications are doing more harm than good in some cases, or in more cases, and the studies have been, you know, have methodological flaws because they haven't taken into account withdrawal effects, you know, then there needs to be a very big rethinking about how much we prescribe medication.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, that's obviously, you describe my job as a psychiatrist to prescribe medications. I would say it's not quite exactly accurate, but it's not that far off, because of course there are people in mental health teams that can do therapy, there are social workers. So one of the core activities of psychiatrists is to prescribe medications. And yes, if that's being criticized, if there should be less of that, if that's doing more harm than good, then it really undermines, you know, one of the core activities of what psychiatrists do. And I think they find that threatening. So it's a little bit analogous to, I said, you know, the doctor sitting there in the office would prefer to dismiss the patient saying what their professors have said is wrong. Now we've gone to the professor level. The professors would rather dismiss the researchers saying what you're saying is wrong and go on with their work. So, you know, I think they find us irritating and frustrating. And I'm sure I would think the same of myself, because if someone was coming along and saying all the work you've done hundreds of studies and you've spent your entire life and actually you've missed some major issues, you know, I wouldn't like that person either. And I'd want to swat them away. And so I think, you know, what happened at that conference was a reaction to that kind of irritation and frustration. And I think it was very one-sided, as you pointed out. We weren't there to present our arguments, and I think that's because they're less interested in our arguments than they should be. You know, I would argue a few things. I would argue there's a very big role for psychiatrists in more rational prescribing. You know, I like you've mentioned, I think there's a role for psychiatric medication. I don't think it should all be thrown over the ship. I think we should be more careful with it. And that involves educated people making decisions about it. And I think psychiatrists, of course, are those people. I think there is a very big project for psychiatrists, which is safety prescribing of medication. You know, I think psychiatrists are very well placed to oversee that. It's a very, you know, it's a rather complicated process. And I think they could contribute greatly to safety prescribing. So I think there are lots of, you know, there's lots of research to be done. There's lots of clinics to be set up. So I think there is work for psychiatrists, but they don't see it like that now, certainly.
Yeah. I guess as a final two questions, what happens now when a patient, say, for example, that someone wants to stop their medication? What is the current recommendation of stopping antidepressants in the UK? From what I know, is it's a gradual reduction, right? But I guess what I'm trying to say is, if anyone wants to safely taper off antidepressants, who do they contact? What kind of help do they seek? Would that be the psychiatrist or the GP? And then the other question would be, and more importantly, I guess, how can we get more rigorous research in this area and have more empirical evidence on the effect?
Yeah, good questions. Your questions are so good, I'm staying longer than I intended to, but that's only because it's a good conversation. I'll take the first question first. So there's a bit of a difference between what the guidelines say and what happens in actual practice. You're quite right about the guidelines. So there's been a very big shift in guidelines recommend in the last few years in England. In no other country has there been the same shift. I think England has been progressive on this issue, and I think that's because there's been a lot of patient advocacy. There's been some recognition by the Royal College of Psychiatrists that's pushed this issue forward, and you're right. So the current NICE guidelines which guide doctors in the country, say there's basically three major principles they say in the guidelines. One is to come off antidepressants gradually, and they suggest, you know, months rather than weeks. And so for some people, we know that will take more than a year or even longer. Number two is do it at a rate the patient can tolerate. So rather than it being just a kind of one size fits all, bang, 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 you've got to see, because everyone's a bit different. It's very hard. We don't have enough information yet to guess who can take 6 months, who will take 2 years. So you've got to monitor patients and adjust the rate to what they can tolerate. And the last point is to go very carefully for the last few milligrams. So because of some work we did, it's known that the last few milligrams of a drug have a lot more effect on the brain than you would expect. So, for example, 2 milligrams of a drug can have half the effect of 40 milligrams, although it sounds like it's much smaller, and that's because of the way the drugs affect the brain, and it means you've got to go very carefully at the last few milligrams, down sometimes by 0.1 milligrams at a time, because that can be the hardest bit to get off. And as part of that, these guidelines recommend that patients should use liquid versions of drugs when necessary so they can do those final small differences. There is guidance from the Royal College of Psychiatrists as well that says some of those things in more detail. Unfortunately, the NICE guidelines are very brief on this, so it's a bit hard for doctors to follow them. Now, what happens when you walk into a doctor's office is a bit different, because when guidelines change, there's always a lag time in people making sense of those guidelines and implementing it in practice. I think I've heard people say it can take 10 years. And that's certainly the impression I get from my inbox, because I get patients around the country emailing me and saying, I've just gone in to see my doctor. I printed out the NICE guidelines. I've asked for a liquid and they said, no, we don't do that. You know, why are you going to all this trouble? You can just split the tablet in two and then stop it after that a couple of weeks. So we know, you know, it is hard to shift practice. There are dozens of guidelines coming out all the time. Doctors have hundreds of important things being thrust in front of their faces, learn this, learn that. So I think in practice, probably what's happening out there is still what's been happening for years, which is doctors are telling people you can split your drug in, you know, halve the drug for a couple of weeks, then halve it again and then stop it. We know that most people cannot come off their drug like that safely. Some people probably can if you've been on it short term, but we know most people can't. So it makes life a bit difficult to give advice to your listeners. You know, I would say the first port of call is to talk to your GP. Sometimes when patients have written to me, I've said, look, print out this page of the guidelines. You know, don't overwhelm your doctors. You know, it says prescribe a liquid. It says go slowly. It says go at a rate patient can tolerate. And sometimes patients have come back to me and said, okay, the doctor changed his mind. He prescribed me a liquid. He's going to let me do it over several months. You know, otherwise what happens is people give up on their doctors and they end up going onto online forums where they get advice. You know, that's often very similar to the NICE guidelines. You know, I think that's a bit irresponsible of the health system. I think the health system is putting people on these drugs. It's their responsibility to take them off it. So I've set up a small clinic to help people stop their drugs in the NHS in London. I think there needs to be many more such clinics around the country. You know, I often think about something like long COVID. You know, people saw very quickly there's a big problem. They set up specialist clinics. I feel like protracted withdrawal and the trouble coming off these drugs is a hidden problem because most doctors aren't seeing it. Yeah. As a result, people are, you know, left to their own devices, and it adds, you know, insult to injury. People are in great difficulties with their health because of the trouble coming off the drugs. And on top of that, doctors are telling them it's in their head, you know, they're crazy. So it means it's very hard for them to get financial support. I'll just give you an example. I'm seeing a patient who has protracted withdrawal, is very unwell, you know, was working in a fancy job, trying to get insurance. And the psychiatrist from the insurance company said, this can't be withdrawal. That only lasts a couple of weeks. This must be depression. He needs more drugs to treat his depression. But he's in protracted withdrawal because of the drugs he was on. So he's very upset. He's very scared that they don't recognize what's going on with him. And that leads to, you know, he's in a very bad way. He's very nervous. He won't have enough money to live. So it becomes, you know, an existential problem for these people. This misunderstanding that seems very minor actually has huge ramifications for people's lives.
And he's now your patient?
Yep, he's now my patient.
So he's in good hands.
Well, that's if people listen to me. So, you know, I wrote a letter And he's got about 25 symptoms of withdrawal. He had mild issues before he went on the drugs. He's the guy who had trouble with exams, you know, like, I mean, like me, who doesn't have anxiety before exams. But the psychiatrist from the company said, you know, no, he's depressed, he's anxious, he needs drugs. So it's not so easy to win these arguments.
And Dr. Horowitz, the second, the last question that I asked about research in the area.
Yep. Well, that's it's a big problem for me. We've put in various grants, research proposals on this topic that have been rejected. It seems much easier. I mean, I think the world is very keen to find the next whiz-bang drug, psychedelics, pregabalin. If you want to put in a study to look at a new whiz-bang drug that'll solve a mental health problem, there seems to be a lot of funding out there. If you're looking at, you know, damage done, problems, doesn't look to be as much interest. I shouldn't be completely bleak. In Australia, I'm helping a professor to run a study on stopping antidepressants, which is a very good study.
Yeah.
So there are little pockets of interest. I think the more people that talk about the problems, you know, I think social media has a small effect. I think the more mainstream media has an effect. Podcasts like you're doing have an effect. I think the more people that hear about it, more people will recognize the troubles that they've had or that their friends and family have had. And the more of the clamor there is, the more likely it is to affect government policy and researchers. So I think, you know, raising awareness is a very important thing to do. And every podcast matters. So good on you for taking up the topic yourself.
Dr. Horowitz, thank you firstly for your work in the field, for allowing people's experiences to be heard, to not feel like they're crazy or have a different diagnosis, to feel also that there's some level of hope to safely get off those medications, and of course, hopefully for the future, not to repeat the mistakes of the past. And of course, a big thank you for coming on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here. Great talking to you.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening. If you did like this episode, please do share, like, and support us by subscribing through your favorite podcast hosting site, as well as sharing this episode. I will also be linking Dr. Horowitz's website, Twitter, and his work to this episode description, so I highly recommend that you check it out. Thank you again, and we'll catch you in the next episode.